Cheers. Toodles.
Toodle pip.
Au revoir.
Are you still recording?
Yeah.
That's so embarrassing. Welcome to another installment of the Clem and Em podcast with me, Clemmy Stewart.
And me, Emma Kell.
How are we doing, Emma?
We are doing well. Another uneventful week of nails and spas, I gather, Clemmy, at your end?
Slightly busier. Finished my TED talk.
Oh, tell us more. How did it go?
It went well, actually. In as much as I feel we survived, it was without a doubt the most terrifying thing I've ever done to date, I think, apart from applying for a headship. But no, it was good. It was good and it was well received, believe it or not.
Brilliant. So tell us a bit about it, because you were talking about parenting.
I was talking about parenting. We were talking about trampoline parenting, and we are urging more parents to be less snowplow, be less helicopter, and be more trampoline parenting, which basically means not creating issues for your children by building in barriers and preventing them from experiencing failure, but actually letting them experience small but useful experiences of failure so they can build on that and develop grit and resilience.
So you did a poll though. So we managed to both end the week. So we were talking before this started to Lee about Twitter and how it can be a little bit fraught at times. And we've managed to both get ourselves on the wrong side of certain people this week, didn't we?
We have. So the TEDx Kingston actually did a poll off the back of our talk because Loose Women open their show on Monday with it, which was a bit of a surprise for everybody. But the question was, you know, are you a trampoline parent or are you a helicopter parent, and so on. And over half, I think, said that they felt they were trampoline parents. But I would argue, having seen lots of children come through primary schools over the last 12 years, I'm not sure they are trampoline parents yet.
So come on, this is interesting. Tell us what the alternatives were, because from what I gathered looking at your timeline, a few people got a little bit upset that you were trying to box their parenting and said, well, I'm all of these and none of these, and don't oversimplify, which I suppose is the danger of Twitter a lot of the time, is that things get oversimplified. But it was lighthearted, but also with a...
Yeah, completely. And I think the starting point for it was obviously a TED Talk. And TED Talks need to grab attention and get people talking and thinking. So if you did a sort of 30-minute talk around general parenting themes, I don't think it would get any traction or conversation. So whilst we know that we are being quite black and white and binary by giving labels, it just gets that conversation going. And in fact, the majority of people off Twitter on a face-to-face basis feel that they are snowplow parents, recognise a lot of those traits in themselves and are trying really hard to address that.
So what's a snowplow parent?
So a snowplow parent forges ahead, cropping down any risk of disappointment in the child's path.
And then you had helicopter parents.
Helicopter parents hover above, waiting for any failure to loom, whereupon they swoop down like paratroopers behind enemy lines.
And then trampoline, you've talked about building
trampoline
resilience.
Parents just bounce their children up, let them experience failure, let them experience independence, have fun, but you remain there as a safety net, so when they fall back down, you wrap around them and bounce them back up again.
And is there another one, or is that those three?
Those are our main ones at the moment.
See, I imagine most of us would like to imagine we're trampoline parents, because it sounds lovely.
Yeah.
But the urge to be a snowplow at times in a world which is volatile and frightening and adolescence is hitting at home, and the urge to just make those mistakes go away before they can even hurt is huge.
And I can imagine that. And we were very, very careful to talk about contextualised trampolining. So in all seriousness...
done your risk assessment.
Yeah, oh, fully. And at one point we put in this line about, you know, let your children walk home tonight. And then we had some advice from somebody who does some PR with United Learning, which is the multi-academy trust I work with, who said, but be careful, because obviously if you're telling everyone to send their children to walk home if something happens. And it was a really good point, because we were thinking about it from a secondary perspective, when actually I don't want my reception girls walking home tonight on their own. It's about building a sensible context.
Now, Clemmy. Six-year-olds wandering around Camden.
On motorbikes.
So that should be more independent.
And that's the thing. So, you know, and again, there was another one where I think Rebecca, who I did it with, said, oh, you know, let them fall out of a tree rather than a soft play area. And again, we thought, no, hang on. No, not a good idea. So we did sort of wash it down a little bit. But those are the key things, is knowing the context. And in fact, I'm now writing a second piece on how you can actually action trampoline parenting.
Right. Oh, wonderful. There's a book in that, Clem.
Well, funny you should say that. that's something we're talking about at the moment.
Watch this space.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we are here with the wonderful Lee Elliott Major, who doesn't know us from Adam, who we approached audaciously out of the blue and who said, yeah, come to my house. And we've met his beautiful family and had a really warm welcome. Yeah. So we're feeling very comfortable indeed. Lee, it's wonderful to meet you. Lee is the first professor of social mobility in the UK.
In the world.
In the world. Wow. Oh, I hadn't realised that. I thought it was in the UK.
Yes, I joke that I am the world's leading professor of social mobility, but my 14-year-old daughter reminds me that I'm the only one. So that's
we were talking about, so kids have a way of bringing us down, don't they? Because we just hustled you upstairs.
Yeah, you were talking about parenting. I think there's roles that children play for their parents, absolutely, which we could discuss.
Yeah, that's
by the way, one thing we found in the book, we did Social Mobility and Its Enemies, which was published a couple of years ago by Penguin. We looked at tiger parenting around the world, yeah, and that was really interesting because we found all sorts of signals that this was starting to happen in the UK, but we called them sort of more panther-like, okay, in that they do all this extra tutoring for their children, but they deny that they're doing it, so that their children are presented as naturally brilliant. And so that was quite interesting hearing you talking about different parenting techniques.
Yeah, and in fact, tiger parenting was one that we talked about when we pitched it to Ted, and it was felt that that was sort of sitting alongside a slightly different conversation, but tiger parenting from a head teacher's point of view is a real issue.
For me, tiger parenting is that moment when somebody hurts your child's feelings and you want to go completely savage, but that's not tiger parenting, is it? I've misunderstood.
I know.
I very rarely go savage, but someone really, really, really hurt my daughter's feelings in a very unfair kind of way, and I felt this whoosh of rage. So, but I think I might be taking the tiger a little bit literally. So, yeah.
It comes mainly from Asian cultures, but also America particularly as well, where parents are doing absolutely everything they can to enable their children to get on in school. And that largely is down to a lot of private tutoring, but also, you know, rushing your children off to various clubs and societies, doing the music, doing the sport, you know, being ultra ambitious for your children in a way which I think actually can be damaging. And we might want to talk a little bit about that, because I think there's a balance.
And that was the question that was coming to my head as you were saying that. So with your perspective as a parent, but also as an educationalist and a professor, where does that happy medium lie for you, do you think, from a parenting point of view?
It's a really good question. And you know, when I talk to parents, I always try and have a discussion about why are you doing this private tutoring? Because one, we know that the quality of tutoring varies a lot. Mm. So, you know, I would argue if you are going to do it, probably go for a teacher or someone who has been a teacher. I know it sounds obvious, but there is a lot of firms out there that do have graduates, you know, and they come from Oxbridge and the leading universities. Now, some of them could be quite good, but others might be the brainiest people in the world, but they're not actually that good at teaching. And so I think, you know, one, you've got to be careful of who you get to tutor your children, but you've also got to think, why is it for? Because I think if you do too much, and by the way, I do have private tutors for my children, just so you know.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons we called the book Social Mobility and Its Enemies was because in a way we're all enemies of social mobility. But anyway, I'll just put that out there. You know, we all want the best for our children.
Yeah, of course.
But you're trying to balance that with how much you want to do for your local community and for other people. But that's another debate. But the problem, I think, with private tutoring is that children become almost used to having other people help them. So so one of the aims that I would argue of education is to create independent learners, right?
Absolutely.
You know, so in my other books, so I'm promoting all my books, so What Works in Education, and that's really a book for teachers, sort of practical guidance for teachers. Yeah, one of the themes in that book is how do you create in your classroom children that themselves are becoming independent learners? And I think that the best teachers are the ones that inspire learning.
Yeah.
And I think private tutoring can go against that. So you get children saying, you know, Where is my tutor for doing this? That becomes the default.
And it's similar with teaching assistants as well, isn't it, in some classrooms, again, where you have to be so careful that you don't breed a culture of dependence. And it comes from the most well-meaning of places, but the children become so reliant, and then you spit them into secondary, where, you know, as I sort of pass my primary baton over to Emma as a secondary teacher, and my understanding is you're then met with children who just sit there waiting for someone to turn the page for them or ask for a ruler.
I actually put my hand up to speak then. So institutionalized
teacher.
Right, so teaching assistants. So you co-wrote the Sutton Trust report, which was a Bible in school. So I remember it being presented to us. It was incredibly powerful. So that's where that frequently cited line about primary schools and homework comes from. And the research says, it was a brilliant piece. There were finding on teaching assistants. Now I'm reading what works at the moment. And it's really interesting what you say about the Bananarama principle. It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. Because I really worry. See? Read it.
We really should have the music in the background.
I know. And I feel like I should have a sticker. You look so proud as a learner that you've read it.
I've myself. I've done my own work.
We'll send you a headgirl badge.
but actually I think it's really interesting, because I was thinking about what you said about independence just then, but also thinking about school budgets and the state we're in. So I think a lot of schools, Rav and I were talking about this on the way here, a lot of schools took that research where you had the cost benefit, and a whole lot of teaching assistants suddenly lost their jobs. And I think you qualify that in some ways in what works, because I know what you mean. There's the whispering radiator teaching assistant where the child gets far too dependent and the teacher doesn't communicate properly and it's just another warm body in the classroom. But then there are the teaching assistants who are just phenomenal. And I'm the best year of teaching of my life. I was lucky enough only 3 years ago to have two teaching assistants with some incredibly needy students. And we acted out an inspector calls with props, with our own poison, not actual poison. because we could, because there were three of us in the room, and we talked about Donald Trump, and we talked about immigration, and bounced off each other. Now, I know that's anecdotal, but I also know that those children's lives are the richer for having had the influence of those teaching assistants. So I don't know.
So I think that this is a really good point. And I remember on the last day of term, present those results that teaching assistants had zero impact on average on attainment to a room of 200 teaching assistants on the last day of term. And I remember they were almost chucking things at me. I mean, and I really felt it, because... you know, actually what we were trying to say with that was that there were some brilliant teaching assistants out there, but there's also some others that weren't doing so well, and that most of the reasons why they weren't doing so well was because they weren't being trained or supported,
planned for,
or helped or planned for.
communicated with.
So I'm a passionate believer in evidence and research, but I think you have to be so careful how you communicate it and how it's taken up by the profession. And in the last 10 years, I've been involved in the sort of evidence-informed movement in schooling. Very proud to be part of that. But I still think we're not quite there in terms of how we enable teachers to understand and communicate that. And one of the things I'm very interested in doing is working with teachers to almost look at some of that research, and with teachers think about how we package that and communicate it for other schools, rather than it being a sort of government top-down sort of message, or you know, I was part of charities that were national, and you need some national sort of messaging. But I do think I'm very interested in how teachers as a profession are empowered, rather than being told what to do and then being misled. So the TAs was a very interesting example. You can't just throw out evidence and then expect everyone to sort of get it. So that there's some and I don't think we're there yet in terms of those debates.
So we took a great sort of live example. We took that data and we looked at working with the Institute of Education with the Maximising Impact of Teaching Assistants programme, with a brilliant lady called Sally, who came down and led some inset with RTAs. And again, she had to stand up and do a sort of similar version of what you're talking about in an inset to a room full of TAs. Guess what, guys? The data shows you're having no impact. And it was one of those where you think, and I remember my deputy head just looked across the room and you didn't tell me she was going to say that. And I was like, no, but it's going to be fine, because we're going to pick up from here. And then we talked at length about those sort of scaffolded opportunities of developing independence rather than dependence, and the types of questioning. And the TAs loved them, went out and tried those, and they came back and different ones were leading on different parts of questioning, and there became this whole sort of coaching approach, and the impact has been enormous. We haven't lost any TAs, we're just changing how we work with our TAs to get the best for our children.
That sounds so good.
It's been brilliant.
Well, I learned a lesson because I put the figures up, the statistics, which had a big fat zero for, and we know other evidence for marking, for example, some really interesting evidence around marking, that the most powerful feedback through marking is comments, actually, is teachers putting comments down about some misunderstandings that the pupil has, and then the pupil responding to that. It has to be genuine feedback. The actual just giving a mark out of 10 actually is not particularly that useful, to be honest. I mean, we all yearn, parents want it and everyone yearns for it. And I made the classic mistake. I put a number up and everyone focused on the number. And then I said, yes, but, and then I'd lost the audience. So that was quite...
Because they know they got 60%, so they don't care what
they wrote. So that was a really... So, you know, again, as a professor of social, you have to try and practice what you preach, and giving, and you two will know this, right? You know, I would love to improve feedback in class. You know, when we did that toolkit that you were talking about 10 years ago now, my God. One of the big things that we found that was most impactful in teaching in schools was effective feedback. Now, that's two words, right? Now, beneath that is so much complexity and so much, you know, and how you communicate with human beings, how one teacher often a class of 30 young people, it's such a complex human interaction going on there, that how you provide individualized, timely feedback to all those 30 pupils that moves their learning on is a wonder in many ways, I think. I think some of the things that we found that almost simple sort of lessons of what works beneath them are quite complex. And I think anyone who underestimates the complexity of teaching, you know, and I get frustrated with some politicians on this, because I think everyone almost feels like they can teach, you know, they sort of think they can. And actually, I think it's one of the most complex things we as humans know.
Love to know a little bit about what made you who you are. What was your school like?
So this is a really good question. And I was just saying to you guys earlier that I don't think hardly anyone's ever asked me these questions.
It's an exclusive, ladies and gentlemen.
Exclusive. And maybe I'll have a nervous breakdown
podcast.
So I remember my first day at primary school, and I remember my mum dropping me off and being, you know, quite attached to my mum, actually, and feeling quite nervous. But then apparently I just kept on following the teacher around, asking lots and lots of questions, you know. And looking back on it now, you know, I ended up sort of being a journalist, and then and now I'm an academic. It was almost sort of destined to be at age 4 or whatever I was, which, again, as a social mobility professor, is quite interesting for me, because, you know, a lot of people say, are they set in train that early? So it's quite interesting when you reflect on your own life, you look back, you think, was I of that nature already at age 4? I don't know. I came from a family that didn't have any higher education. So I was the first person to go to university. We'll come on to that in a bit. But yeah, I enjoyed primary school. And what helped me was, and I only have vague memories of this, to be honest, but a teacher just took me on, basically. That you know, I was from it was a very relatively poor area in London, a place called Felton, which is famous for its young offenders institution.
I feel really guilty. That's the first thing I said.
No, it's absolutely true. You know, so it was quite a rough, and I always say to people, you know, living in London in the late 70s, early 80s was quite hard, actually. You know, I remember, because I had, when I was at secondary school, I was at an all-boys school, but, you know, I had Asian friends, I had black friends. You know, we were quite a multicultural group, but we got picked on a lot. We were beaten up by skinheads.
For being multicultural.
And we were all quite trendy. We had all cool haircuts.
I may have seen a picture on the way.
Might be the cover of the podcast.
So we did attract attention, but, you know, I always wish we'd been some sort of first multicultural proper rock band or something. But anyway, it didn't happen. So it was quite a rough area, a rough time. You know, I think London's become quite gentrified now, too rich and too expensive for many people, but it definitely has become gentrified. So I enjoyed primary school, but it was a teacher who really sort of backed me, I suppose, gave me a bit of confidence.
And how old were you then?
So that would have been about 8 or 9. And I remember it wouldn't happen these days. So I end up going to a school called Eyesworth and Zion School, which was Eyesworth Grammar. So it had been a grammar school. It just converted to a comprehensive and all boys school. And I just remember these teachers coming from this other school, which was the big school, which clearly wasn't. And they picked four of us out. And I really do not to this day know how it all worked. But we were sort of told, look, you know, and my mum and dad, who didn't really understand what was going on, they were told, well, you know, your son, be good if he went to this school, which was 5 miles away, you know, from where I lived. So that was interesting, because these days I don't think that would happen. I don't think we would just pick.
Unless it was a programme sponsored by some famous
teacher. Tell us about the teacher who really made the difference then.
So I just remember, do you know what? I don't remember, his name was Mr. Messiter, I think it was, and he had a beard, I remember. But he was just a very nice, and I remember him being a very gentle man, but he just had faith in me in a way that no one had done before. I remember he confiscated my Lego. I brought in the Lego on the wrong day or something, and I remember that being a big thing. And so no, it was, you know, and I think those things matter. And a lot, you know, I do a lot, as you know, a lot of studies are very sophisticated, looking at thousands of statistics on these sort of issues of educational inequality and social mobility in different countries. But actually, honestly, it comes down to people helping other people. And I'm very passionate about this, because I fear that we've become a very individualistic society in many ways. I think we bought into the American dream, which in my view is a very individualistic notion of success.
It's quite a selfish approach.
It's a very selfish, like, you know, I've made it, I'm going to, and a lot of the TV programs are sort of centered on that. And I think we should value, I know you, this is very predictable for a professor of social mobility, I know, but, you know, we should value people that give back to other people. So teachers, for example, you know, I think we should value and pay them more as well. It's not just about pay, but it's about status as well. And for whatever reason, I think we've become very individualistic culture. But when you ask people, and I want you to do this with your future podcast as well, because, you know, how did you become a success, however that's defined? I suspect most people have been helped along the way by teachers, family. And
most
it's usually,
have mentioned a teacher, haven't they? Most have. There is a specific teacher who's almost similar to your story, sort of sniffed them out, mentored them in some way, shape or form. I think Dad talked at length about his teacher that did that.
Yeah.
And teachers don't realise, and I've had this as well as a sort of teacher as well, that, you know, you can say things, you'll just say, you know, how many words you say in one lesson in one day? Lots, right? And someone will pick up something you said.
Yeah.
That could affect them for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
And, you know,
for better or worse.
For better or worse. And often for good. I you know, most teachers don't realise actually how much impact they have.
I think when you've been doing it for a few years and you get these arbitrary contacts out of the blue, and they'll say to you, thank you for that time when you walked me around when I was really stressed before the exam. You know, and they're the tiniest things.
Yeah.
You do realise that long term.
And do you know what? I think the shoe also goes on the other foot, where I think there are certain children that we as teachers just remember. Whether you just got something back from them, or you knew you'd had impact on them, or they just knew you well enough that, I don't know, you just have that really special relationship.
You know, I was thinking about that a lot, because I was thinking about it in the context of social mobility, and there's that, I don't know where it comes from, either reference to that awful graph where, you know, more or less where you started is where you're going to end up. I don't know what the source of that is, but I always think of it. And I worked around here, we're in Camden now, in one of the lowest achieving schools, and in the early 2000s, and the students were incredibly vulnerable, and we loved those students. Yeah, those students, we were in loco parentis, and we took that role very seriously. I still worry that we almost took that role too seriously and didn't give them that resilience and independence that they need.
Very interesting.
Because we were ultimately professionals who moved on, because our lives moved on. And I'm still in touch with a lot of those students, and some of them, like you, have gone on to make a success of themselves. Often those were the parents, the grandparents, but some are still pretty much where they were and struggling, really struggling in those sort of...
I think there's some real resonances with a lot of what happened in the 80s where I grew up, where inequality in society increased, and I think we became more divisive. Divided society, and I feel that at the moment. I don't want to depress your, but And one of the things when I visit schools, what I'm realizing is, and we might get into this a bit more, is I think there's so much pressure on teachers now to solve all of society's ills, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I think there's too much pressure now put on teachers. I think we must challenge teachers and schools mm. to do the best they can. But all the evidence that I've gathered and others have shown that if you don't deal with inequalities outside the school gates, as well as improving schools at yeah. the same time, you're not going to have much chance in terms of proving social mobility. What's happening at the moment, it's really interesting hearing what you were doing in would that be the 80s or 90s? Anyway, before. Mm. But a lot of schools, I would argue now, are entering into becoming social wealth. It's almost like social wealth. Yeah. It's almost like being parents,
you're
really.
You're their parent, yeah.
And I, in a way, I think we need a discussion about that. We need a debate about what are the boundaries of school. What do we expect our yeah. schools to do? So a lot of the zero tolerance schools, if you go to them, you know, if you really extend that to its furthest, you know, they will do everything from eating for feeding. You know, I've seen programs around sleep, you know, how do you educate? Mm. And I can understand it on one level, but I just think if we're serious about that, then school should be paid for doing that. And we should look at what works best, yeah. et cetera, et cetera.
And I think, again, I would agree with that completely and say that you'd also then need to make sure they had the training and the understanding. And I certainly remember I used to work in a school in an army, a garrison town. It was a school in special measures at the time. And it was when we were out in Afghanistan. So lots of the parents were out in Afghanistan, both mums and dads. And we were doing a lot of those things you're talking about. So we were making sure that they had eaten. We were buying plimsolls in Primark because they didn't have shoes in PE. Yeah, because again, it was not a priority at home at that point, which I totally get. Mm. But when you start wandering into the realms of mental health, social care, you don't cover that on a PGCE. Mm. And as well-intentioned as it might be, you might also be doing completely the wrong
thing. I totally
thing.
Agree with
and,
that.
And that's quite totally a scary prospect.
Yeah. I totally agree. So one of the things I'd love to do, again, I wish I had time to do all these things, is to help teachers decide what are the most effective practices and yeah. which are the ones that you should choose given the limited time that you have. But you know, so all those things I think resonate with me in terms of my schooling. And when I went to secondary school, I had some negative experiences with teachers mm-hmm. as well. I mean, you know, I remember one physics teacher, I think he was just out of training, and I always remember, again, I was asking those questions, you know, and he said, look, Lee, the syllabus doesn't go, you know, that's the, you can't ask any more questions because, you know.
And you were asking the questions.
Yeah,
again.
And he obviously didn't know the answer to this question. Now, the thing, you know, I did physics, by the way, I did my first degree and PhD in theoretical physics.
We won't be touching on the subject matter in there today.
it stops conversations dead when I say that. But, and this was a physics lesson, and I just remember being crestfallen because, you know, I mean, I think good learning and good science in many ways is about asking questions, and often we don't Absolutely. Know the answers. And I think some of the best writers actually in science and education are the ones that say, look, we don't know all the answers. Yeah. And I think a lot of children need to know where the boundaries are.
Well, and those are often the best lessons.
They are.
Let's scrap this and find out.
Yeah. Actually, a child asks you something.
And you say, no, well, we don't, no one knows.
Yeah,
you know.
Or go and find out. How many tenses are there in French? So you go and find out. Find out and come back and tell us.
So that was a bit, I remember being a bit frustrated with that. And then I, you know, lots of things happened in my personal life. You know, my mum and dad split up. I ended up living on my own, which is amazing now thinking about it because I've got children.
How old were you?
I was going to say how old.
So I was around 16, so quite young. And I remember having to go to the Social Security office and having to convince them. It's a long story. And I wasn't really talking to my dad, I needed a letter from one of my parents to prove that I was on my own, but we couldn't get that. And I remember having this argument, having queued up for half a day, having to say to them, look, surely just because I'm on my own shouldn't mean that I shouldn't get some support. And in the end, I did get some support. And we had to talk to them about getting a maintenance grant. In those days, you got a maintenance grant for going to university if you didn't have family support. So that taught me a lot, actually, about resilience, to be honest. I think there were some good things around that. You know, I'm quite resilient now.
Did your school, so going back to what you were saying earlier about schools and identifying issues and the support they provide, was your school able to provide any support to you at that stage?
Some teachers, I remember, were very... very supportive. But I kind of went off the rails a bit. You've got to realize I look quite scary at this point, right? You know, I had blonde spiky hair, I had eyeliner, big hooped earrings. You know, that's I right. think they knew who I was because I'm a very open, I've always been a very open person, but I think only so much they could do, right? There's only so much to do. And then I went, it's interesting, then I went to retake, I eventually retook my A-levels at a tertiary college, Richmond College, and that was a different experience because I didn't know hardly anyone there. It was a big college. And I'll always remember that because I went into, I think it was a math lesson, and I think because the way I looked, the teacher, because they didn't know me, immediately thought I was just a nobody. Aww. But then he asked a question, and I remember no one else in the class knew the art, and I sort of put my hand up at the back, and I said, "Oh, is it?" And I just remember the look on his face was, "Wow, you know, where did that come from?" And so then he helped me a lot. One thing I do reflect on, and now I have my own children, I think, is that I was, in a sense, lucky because I was academic, right? So yeah. I could kind of do it. What I worry about is that the children who aren't academic, and I think our school system is too narrowly focused on a very narrow notion, actually, of what we measure as success. And it's it's about memorizing key facts and figures and, you know, and doing that in a two-hour, three-hour test at the end of the year. You know, I think that does do something, but it certainly, for me, doesn't measure all the talents, you know, creative, vocational. And I'm really passionate about trying to reform the system, actually, to develop all our children. I was the lucky one in many ways.
Yeah. So this topic's come up a lot in the podcast. Yeah. I know Fiona Miller feels particularly strongly about this. We had another long conversation about vocational education. Oh, it was Alistair. Alistair talked about
nearly everybody we've spoken to.
And this is it's not so new anymore. It shows a sign of my age. I was going to say the new GCSE. It's not so new, which came in, 5 years ago in the English and maths. So what would you do instead?
So I think, scandals with the education system at the moment is that we fail about 40% of our children, right?
So these are the students who don't get a grade 4 and above.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or 5, or whatever measure we're using.
Whatever measure we use, yeah. And that's kind of hardwired into our system now. And I'm not saying you can't, you know, assess academic ability, however you define it. But I do think other countries have better systems in that they have a basic sort of threshold, a sort of almost national certificate that every child is expected to pass. I think that's more about having functional basic literacy and numeracy, and we can have discussions about what we mean by that. I still think a lot of the GCSE maths is, you know, I mean, I speak as a theoretical physicist. there's lots of equations in it, and for me, it's lovely. I used to sit down with my children and go, "Oh, you can do it this way, but you can also solve it this way." And they're looking at me with blank faces.
They don't want to know 15 ways of doing it.
And I think there's too much that's theoretical academic in that examination. Mm. I would have a more basic threshold that every child should surpass, and then you can still have your ranking of academic stuff. But I think we don't focus on what are the key skills that everyone leaving school at age 18 these days should have.
And would you look at reorganising that with a group of people across industry, across society, across politics? Again, I think certainly what we've heard a lot recently is it's so narrowly focused on GCSE leading to A-level, leading to a degree, leading to a job, which is a great path for some of our children. It's certainly not a great path for every child. And I think if you're not taking that path at the moment, I think many do still wrongly feel like they've therefore failed. And if they're going to settle for an apprenticeship or settle for going straight into work, when actually for a lot of kids, that is completely the right approach. But how can we go about changing that narrative, do you think?
I totally agree with you that you need different perspectives and different voices. So one of the issues with low social mobility is that you have very similar people at the top of society, and they all tend to come through a very academic route. So, you know, I've interacted with governments over many years now, the advisors, the ministers, the civil servants. Lots of very nice people, by the way, who are very well-meaning. But I just think they all come from the same sort of, I mean, I character a little bit, but often they're the same Oxford colleges. And I'm not saying, you know, diversity, I mean, you know, I'm not saying we don't have any Etonian Oxford people, but I do think we need other people with other experiences. So yeah. whether it be in industry, whether it be someone who's come through a further education college, because I just think that we, if you haven't experienced it, it's very hard to understand what it's like for people that aren't academic. And listen, the other argument I get on this is, Lee, you know, what about people like you, you know, who might have been consigned to some vocational route, who were naturally academic. So I think you've got to be careful how you design the system. But other countries do this. And I think, you know, it's for me, there's something about having a basic sort of expectation of what we want from our children. And it feels very academic to me. So I think you're right. You'd need to sort of get people from outside government. You'd need different perspectives, certainly.
Mm. And who do you think gets it most right? I know no one's perfect, but if you're, you know, you're studying across other countries, where do you feel actually they've got something really good here?
Canada, I quite like, because they have they have this threshold. So you know, they've got quite high social mobility rates. I think part of that's around culture, because I don't think they have the hierarchy that we, you know, is part of British life.
Yeah.
So universities are kind of all quite good. There's not this sort of hierarchy, and the private school sector is not quite as strong there. So it's sort of, but I think part of it for Canada is they have this sort of ethos, which is that every child would get over a certain sort of threshold. So there are other countries as well. I mean, people talk about Scandinavian countries. I talk about less about them because I think the societies are so different to ours. I quite like the comparisons where you kind of think Canada's a bit. We'll see how it pans out for the royals over there. But you know, but it's sort of similar in some ways. Canada more than America in some ways, actually.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think there are some good examples out there.
But it's not working at the moment. We're not keeping our best teachers.
Did you see that on Twitter this weekend or last weekend, where there was a clip from the TES International Schools Fair, and everyone was going, "Oh, it's so great! Look how many turned out." I felt sick to my stomach. There was a room full of people.
Oh, who want to?
Then this enormous queue, and this man was just following this queue all the way down, and I just felt sick thinking these are talented, gifted people lining up to leave. That terrified me.
It is terrifying.
So I completely agree with you. They're incredible. British teachers work. English, British teachers in the UK work incredibly hard, but they're stretching themselves too thin. And I like the way in What Works that you do acknowledge workload when you're talking about marking, and you do talk about, I think you talk about teacher integrity, there's a little bit on that in there as well, because we have a huge problem at the moment, and I'm currently working to train teachers, and already there are some of them who are starting to say, look, I love the job, I love the students, I love my colleagues, but the workload, the prescription, the hyper accountability is just too much. Now, I know I'm coming from it very much as I'm still quite passionate about it because I'm inside it and you're inside it as well. I was wondering how you see that.
Yes, well, I mean, I love doing my lectures for trainee teachers. You know, I do at Exeter University, and it's so heartwarming because you see these young people who are absolutely committed. They're going, but part of me is also thinking, right, what are you letting yourself in for?
And
right,
40% of you will be gone within 5 years if the current trend continues.
So I do think we need, you know, if I was talking to the education secretary right now, you know, I would say one thing is we've got to sort out, well, workload is an obvious thing, but I actually think, you know, all the evidence suggests that you teachers, and you guys are kind of doing this now in many ways, it should have time for professional learning, you know. So you know, a lot of the countries that seem to do well will have time factored in, so you've got to pay for this, by the way. It means you've got to pay for what you get. So one of the messages of social mobility, to be frank, is you've got to pay for it, you know. And I worry sometimes about the sort of shortcut sort of ways of you know, of solving these issues. They're big issues, right? So I would put more money into the education system, and a lot of that would be around how do we enable teachers to have professional learning. And that might mean, you know, hours in the day where you're talking to other teachers about what works, what hasn't worked in your school context. You've got the books like What Works. You can say, okay, they've suggested this, but does that work for us? Mm. And, you know, and I just don't think we do that enough. I mean, yeah. one of the ironies of teaching is it's very poor on learning in terms yeah. of professional learning, yeah. right?
And I worry about the Matthew effect amongst teachers as well, because all of the Twitter community and everything else and the Saturday training and things are only realistically open to a certain group. You know, there are a number of teachers who, for all sorts of reasons, don't want to be going to CPD yeah. on a Saturday
yeah.
for free.
Yeah. So
I worry about the Matthew effect amongst schools. Where there are some teachers who are really on it with the research and many who are getting left. Not left behind, actually, because they're probably reading books, but they're not doing the whole.
And I suppose this is also where the Charter College is so important, where, you know, someone's doing a lot of that research for you. They're taking the brilliant things that you've written and they're distilling it almost into a, you know, 10-minute coffee in the staff room. Have a quick flick through this article and it will help you. And in fact, I've been asked to speak about the Charter College for United Learning students, just talk about the impact it has and why we should all be signing up for it. We're very lucky at UL. We've been, every member of staff has been given a membership to the college, which I think is really forward thinking from our maths, but it's just making sure everyone then accesses it and makes the most of it and doesn't think, oh, I've not got time for that. Actually, you have. Let's make it bite-sized and make it something that you can use.
I think the other big issue for me is getting teachers to teach in the schools that most need them, right? So they're, you know, and again, you know, I know I'm asking for more money, but I would give more money for the pupil, you know, the pupil premium grant where you get a bit of extra money for helping children that, you know, on free school meals. I actually think that we don't give enough for that. You know, there's all sorts of debates. Has it been well used? And I think, you know, schools that are in very challenging areas of the country, I think they should be given more money to do. Now, the caveat to that, of course you want accountability and you want it spent on the right things, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that they don't get enough. I think we need to recognise that some teachers in some schools are doing really challenging work. So how you enable, you know, teachers to go to areas of the country which need them the most, I think is a really key issue. And we've never really solved that one.
See, that's interesting, because I'm doing some work over in an opportunity area. And you can see why young people don't want to go and live there. It's a low population. Young people want to go and socialise and fall in love and have a pub on the corner. It's quite simple.
Yeah.
But there is some really good work going on in some of those, actually, Fenlands opportunity areas, for example, that could be built upon.
I think over the next 10 years, we're going to have a lot more debates about the geography of inequality, if you like. And I know the current government are thinking about this, you know, with the North at the moment. And how do we enable our teachers, but also other people, to get jobs in these parts of the country? One of the books I was thinking of doing was London versus the rest. So it's not North versus South anymore. And I think London is a very special place. You know, I'm from London, but I do think that it can almost look after itself in many ways. It's an international metropolis and we need to focus more on the schools elsewhere.
And one of our listeners, actually, and this is Julie, hello, we listen to you, has actually pointed out that actually almost everyone we've spoken to has been from London.
Yeah.
And we need to be,
I think that's
less
absolutely
London-centric.
Right.
Get ourselves out there
and opening up that perspective a bit more. Right. Yeah. So, Lee, if you were a teacher,
I've never. I always say this when I give talks. I've never actually done a prop. I've helped teachers in class. I've in various ways, but I've never done it on my own.
So, if you were to go into the local comprehensive,
there's still time.
Would you be a physics teacher? What would you teach? What kind of teacher would you be, and what would you teach?
So, I have thought about this a lot over the years, and you know, I would want to go to a further education college. I think it's going back to the basics I was talking about earlier, you know, because the children that I worry most, I worry a lot for all children like me who come from my backgrounds that don't end up going to, you know, the top universities. I think that is a legitimate challenge. But the ones I really worry about are the ones that leave school without the basics. So I think if I was going to do anything, I think it would be teaching the basics.
Yeah.
So we avoid NEETs.
In an area where no one else wants to go to. And this is obviously it's an ideal, but, and just to see, given all the evidence that I've gathered over the years, can I do it with the children that need it the most?
One of my friends, Jackie, does it. Yeah. She works with the students who have failed English and maths, and I'm afraid that is the word, failed, and failed English and maths again, and failed English and maths again, and it's tough, and it hasn't necessarily got the funding or the kudos. But interesting you said that, because I quite fancied doing that at one point as well.
I suppose I believe that every human being has talent, and you know. And by the way, the studies that I've seen show that the best teachers are the ones that really do have those fundamental beliefs. So at least I have that. You know, they really believe that everyone can learn.
Belief and faith.
So what kind of teacher would you be? So we've got, we've seen many versions of Lee. So we've got the professor, the Exeter University professor. We've got the
rocker.
The rocker being beaten up by skinheads and clubbing.
The blonde, the peroxide with the earrings.
So would you be... what kind of teacher would you be? Would you be the approachable friend? Would you be sharing your anecdotes with them?
Probably. I think, again, I always say every education minister, by the way, should do a session in class. I think they will find how
I would love
that.
To see that Friday afternoon on a rainy day just after PE.
And reception. They should also do early years.
But I have done teaching. I do lecturing, and I've done. I put my heart and soul in that, and that's the thing. I find it exhausting just doing 1 hour, to be honest with you. And so I have so much admiration for teachers, because you're doing it all time, all day, every day.
Would you be the one where you've got the kid in the front, the cheeky one who knows how to derail you, who says to you, sir, tell us the story again about the kitten that nearly got run over. You would. or please tell us again that story about the time when you went to that club in Hoxton. And then the next thing.
I think
the challenge for me, I think, would be just making sure I could keep the behavior and the discipline, you know, because you've got to have boundaries. You've got to have boundaries as well. And I think that's probably where I'd have to work harder on. Because, you know, when you're an academic, it's such a privileged position, because you've got these older trainee teachers and they're all interested and it's all very, very nice, isn't it? But actually, So I think I would have some challenges as well.
Lee, you've given us so much to think about. And as ever, I don't know about you, Emma, whenever I leave these conversations, my mind mulls for hours and hours, and my poor husband will hear about this till about 10 o'clock tonight, because it always leaves me thinking those bigger questions. But thank you so much for this evening, for making us so welcome and talking with such candour and honesty about what's working and where we need to focus our efforts next.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you very much.
So we've just been sat here for several minutes thinking about which part of that fascinating conversation to focus on, because there was so much there to think about. But I think for me, the thing that really stuck out was that idea of mentorship, and one teacher just identifying that here was a little boy that needed a bit of extra guidance, a bit of extra support. And the fact that Lee sits here now, having gone through all the experiences he has and still remembers that teacher, I think is a huge, huge takeaway for me.
I'm just thinking of things teachers said to me and things I might have inadvertently said to young people. So I remember my physics teacher, and I shared this with my class, my year 11s, and they said, "Miss, that's deep." He said, "She's doing all right. She's never going to set the world alight." And I'm going to confess to this, and I'm kind of curling up inside. So my friend Lucy's daughter was tiny, and she was drawing. I was in my early 20s. This child was drawing. And I said, "Oh, I've always been rubbish at art too." About 10 years later,
cringing.
I know, 10 years later, Lucy said to me, "You know, she's always hated art ever since you said that."
But you know, Emma, this is so interesting. And in fact, you know, to link it back around, and I'm not doing this on purpose, Talk, it's the same for parents. So I mentioned in the talk that when my father said to me in the most sweet and loving way, "You're a Stuart and Stuarts are bad at maths." And I remember it to this day, and he meant it in the nicest possible way, but my God, has it stayed with me. I did intermediate paper, I got a B. That was the last time I danced with maths, and it's never been good. And I think you have to realise the impact of your words as a parent, as a teacher, as a boss, as a mentor. You know, when you're mentoring NQTs and you go, "Oh, good luck, it never gets any easier." You might have just said that after a bad day, but you know that NQT takes that. And then they go on Twitter go, "This is it for me, I can't cope." And then we all wade in and say, "You can, it's the best job in the world." But my
those
gosh.
Words have stayed with them. So yeah. I had an NQT, not even NQT, PGCE student come to me and say, "I've fallen in love and I'm leaving because my mentors told me I can't have a relationship and be a teacher."
Oh, God.
And she left. the next day because it's
the power of words. And I think we have such a responsibility as teachers and leaders and educators and podcasters even. Let's be mindful of our words. Let's be mindful of what we say.
Oh yeah, you're
if we've
right.
said anything, we're sorry.
Yeah, all of it.
Yeah, because it's so important. Well,
now you're making me do a rewind button over all the possible ways and which we could both have offended anyone this week.
Exactly. And I think, again, let's be mindful. And one thing that certainly came up we were talking about today is the fact we don't seem to leave London, which is ironic because I actually don't like London. I flourish in mud. No, I flourish
London.
In mud and air and not seeing anybody. But we need to go north. We need to go east. We need to go west.
We've been quite highbrow so far in the sense that we've done a lot of intellectual conversation. Yeah. We would like to talk to sports people. We would like to talk to people who've had a really rubbish time at school but been successful regardless. So if you've got any suggestions for people you'd like to hear, please do get in touch.
Yeah, and you can do that on Twitter. So I'm on at cstewartshs.
And I'm at those that can.
And if you use the hashtag Clem&M podcast, we'll be able to follow the threads and pick up the themes.
Thank you, and do join in the conversation.
The Clem&M podcast with Clemmie Stewart and Emma Kell. Produced by Rav Vadgama. The Clem&M podcast is a Those That Can production.